This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
No love at all.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, it's just thrilling. Our guest is Paolo Bacigalupi. If you don't know, you will. Stay tuned. Fletcher Henderson and his orchestra. Two cuts, Chinatown, My Chinatown, and Zulu's Ball. And, of course, we opened with Peter Schickele from the soundtrack of the motion picture Silent Running, the Space Fleet, music that has served as the opening theme music for Hour of the Wolf since 1972. It might as well be 18-aught, whatever. Steampunk radio. Speaking of steampunk radio, ZBS, wonderful producers, are just finishing their steampunk radio drama. Everybody else streams it. I keep meaning to ask them if we can't broadcast this. We did the Fourth Tower of Inverness and a lot of their classic stuff from the late 70s, including, of course, Ruby Galactic Gumshoe featuring the Android Sisters, and a classic, wonderful, wonderful radio drama that we didn't produce, but nevertheless, wonderful stuff. So find them online. They stream, and they're carried a lot of places. A lot of it is free, but like everybody else, all good arts organizations can use money. So ZBS is the thing to look up. This Tuesday, I told you that the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings was over for the year. I lied. I lied because of Nightshade Books and Little Brown, okay? I lied because John Joseph Adams told me that this year's Nebula Award-winning novelist, Paolo Bacigalupi, was going to be in town in May. And then it turned out that, no, he was going to go to Florida, where actually we sat at the same place where we do the readings, where they were doing a webcast of the Nebula Awards at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, and it was surreal. We had one of the nominees with us, Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, and she was, well, nervous.
Sure.
She was nervous. We were going to have a gentleman there by the name of Saladin Ahmed. Mm-hmm. But he decided last moment to abandon his newborn twins and wife. Well, Haley, they figured out how to get a proper babysitter. And, you know, if he didn't win, and we all had a feeling that neither of them would win, but if he didn't win, it's his first nomination, for God's sake.
I went for mine.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember it. I remember it well.
Yes. Yeah. But you won.
I went,
you remember your short story?
Yeah, I was up for the People of Sand and Slag, several years ago, and, Kelly Link was the juggernaut that year.
Ah, okay, yes. As she
you can't really lose to a nicer person, so it was wonderful.
But that's true. Kelly's wonderful. She's really neat. And I hope she's doing, I hope we'll see her at ReaderCon.
Yeah.
I haven't, she went through a difficult birthing process recently, and, I always get the name of their magazine, Gavin and Kelly's magazine. I'd say Lady Chatterley.
Lady Churchill.
Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful small press book. And everybody, remember, to support small presses and independent presses.
Support zines, that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, and independent presses. Boy.
Yeah.
Without independent presses, I'd be out of luck.
Well, Little Brown, which just published Shipbreaker, is not an independent press. They're thoroughly vested.
I'm sort of splitting the difference between Little Brown and Nightshade.
So. Okay, yeah. But Nightshade Books put out Pump Six and Other Stories, which is an incredible debut collection. By the time it came out, how many stories in here? I found it. John Joseph Adams gave me this.
Really?
Which I am so grateful for.
That's a collectible.
It is. It really is. Do you know what this is selling for, this book? Everybody looking here. See it on the radio? You know what this is selling for on Amazon?
I've heard numbers. I've stopped looking at it because it seems a little crazy to me.
So. The low price is one person who's lowballing everybody else and selling it for about $250.
Okay.
And not even autographed, which before this show is done or right after, this is going to be autographed.
eBay bait right there.
Oh, God, yes. It's a joke I tell to people. They say, how do I spell your name? I say, it's E-B-A-Y.
Right.
I've got my Heinleins and I've got my Tolkien. And
sweet.
These are autographed, so, you know.
Retirement is secure.
Yeah, if only I could sell them, but I'd be on the street clutching those. There are 9 books, ten stories rather, in
I think there's 10 stories
in Pump Six.
Yeah.
Of those, how many were nominated for various, between the Sturgeon Award and the Locus Award and the Nebulas and the Hugos?
Oh gosh, so there was a Locus winner in there. There was I think there are 3 Hugo.
Yeah,
nominations in there.
There are 3 Hugo.
There's a Nebula nomination in there. There's the Sturgeon win in there. There are a couple of Sturgeon nominations.
There's more nominations than there are stories.
Really?
I
haven't added that.
Add them up. There's more than 10. There's more than 10 nominations, and it's 10 stories in the book. No wonder it's the average price is about $400. No wonder. But I mean, the key is that it happens to be out of print.
Scarcity.
Yeah, scarcity at the moment. Is it in print in ebook format?
Yeah, it is in ebook format at webscriptions.net. And so that's the only way to get it right now is to go to webscriptions.net and download it. It's only about $6 for an ebook.
Yeah.
And then the next time it's actually going to be available, I think, is in November, about, is when they're going to release a trade paperback, finally. So,
oh, finally, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's also a bunch of your stories online for free.
Mm-hmm.
Tor.com just pubbed one this week.
That's right, in fact, yeah. Yeah, they just put one up. There's sort of a scattering of stories, and those continue to sort of, like, trickle out in their little spot. So, yeah, there's one that Pyre Books has called The Gambler. There's... Nightshade Books, actually, on their website at nightshadebooks.com, they actually released a couple of stories that relate directly to the Wind Up Girls universe. The Calorie Man and Yellow Card Man are both available for download there. And so, yeah, there's little pieces around that are sort of for free and DRM free, and you can just download them and do whatever you want with them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Last week, when I had Mary Robinette Cowell on the show, last minute we recorded her. She too was in town, sort of unbeknownst to her that she was going to be here. She was actually here for a theatrical audition.
Okay.
A puppeteer.
Okay.
Theatrical
cool.
audition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she but I was able to work things out, record her, get it on the air. We talked a lot about ebooks and reading aloud, because she's a superb actress,
uh-huh,
a voice
right,
actress
right, right.
and stuff. And we one of the first things when I got myself my little Murph phone. I call it a Murph. It says something else, but I call it Murph from made out by the Moogle people, the Muggle people.
Uh-huh.
That's it, the Muggle people. And one of the first things when I put an e-reader on here, and this now has Kindle on it.
Okay, yeah.
One of the first things I saw were stories by her and a story by you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, just, you know, searching for free stories, good books, or feed books, is one of the free distributors.
Yeah, it could
or
be.
Or distributors of free books.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very cool thing. And I'm mentioning it not because I want to talk about that business this morning, but I'm mentioning it to tell listeners that they can all get a taste.
Indeed, there are a lot of tastes lying around. Yeah, and a few. the big trick really is getting to them, because you can't really Google for my name easily. Paolo Bacigalupi doesn't really Google up tidily when you're trying to type it in. Though
yeah,
I've been noticing that Google starts, you know, saying, "Did
it
you
starts
mean?"
it does, and it also anticipates
you
when you put in Paolo.
Oh, really?
Paolo. It anticipates you and a singer.
Wow.
But you're up there.
Wow, that's interesting.
You're up there at this point. And, you know, doing the James Lipton thing, going to the next point in your career, and I'm no less fawning, by the way, than Lipton, then your first novel came out.
Right, The Wind
Which is
Girl.
Weird, by the way. Why does Scott Westerfeld say on the back of this first novel? It's of, the ship, of Shipbreaker.
Shipbreaker actually is my first novel.
Ah.
It's interesting because if you...
I haven't read it yet.
It's not my first one released, but it was actually the first one that I sold and completed and sold. I was actually in the middle of writing The Wind-Up Girl, and it was... Writing The Wind-Up Girl was a really, really long process. It took me about 3 years to write Wind-Up Girl. And after I'd been going for about 2 years on it, I finally had what I would call sort of a messy draft. And I finally had something that I was ready to show to my agent and sort of say, hey, this is the direction I'm going. You'd better see this now, because if you're concerned now, it's only going to get worse. And so you should see what I'm doing here, because this, you know, if I'm going to shoot myself in the foot with my whole writing career, you should see that early. So I sent that off to her, and I was expecting that to take quite a long time for her to sort of, you know, parse through it and stuff like that. And so in the meantime, I sort of took a break and decided that I was going to write another book. And I wanted to do something really different. Same sort of themes that I like to work with, but,
yes,
but something that was more adventure-y, more fun, more of a palate cleanser from sort of the morass that I sort of found myself inside of when I was writing
The Wind-Up Girl. The Sorbet of Dystopia.
Right, exactly.
There's a title.
Right.
The Sorbet of Dystopia.
So, I've got asthma. So
I should point out, by the way, we have a lovely little device there.
You see
where it says cough?
So you can hear. Yeah. Oh, this is really bad. I'm going to play with that all
yeah,
day.
Yeah, there
great.
You go.
Yeah, I've got asthma, and so every once in a while it triggers. So I apologize.
So do I, but I get control my mic.
Right.
And I can't anticipate it as well for you, but...
Yeah, so we'll see how this goes. Anyway, though, so I wrote Shipbreaker actually pretty quickly. I had a lot of the elements inside of my head already, and it just sort of flowed out. And so I just about had completed a draft of that when my agent got back to me about Wind-Up Girl. I started working on Wind-Up Girl. I finished up Shipbreaker and sort of sent that off to her and sort of blindsided her with it. I said, oh, well, yeah, well, I'm working on Wind-Up Girl. Here's this other book. Try this one. And she read it, and it was it's intended as a young adult book. And she read it, and she said, wow, this is actually pretty good. Okay, I'll take this out. This wasn't what we were talking about, and isn't what I expected, but sure, I'll try to take it out. And Little Brown ended up making an offer on it.
That's great.
Yeah, it was.
So that explains the Scott Westerfeld
right.
quote on the back.
No,
calls it the first novel.
No, he's dead right. It is my debut novel.
Yeah.
It was the first one that I wrote all the way to completion and got sold and got a publisher and that whole bit. And that was like, that was actually my virgin book, really. The thing is Little Brown moves at a much more sedate pace, I guess,
yeah.
or deliberate pace, maybe is what we should call it, a deliberate pace in terms of how they move through their process for publishing a book. And
what's the lead time there? It's about 2 years or something?
Yeah, it was almost 2 years.
Yeah.
There it is again. Yeah, it was almost 2 years. And so in the meantime, I finished up The Wind-Up Girl and sent that out, and it was actually roundly rejected by most of the major publishing houses, and finally found its way to Nightshade Books.
Mm-hmm.
And Nightshade took it, and they were really excited about it, and they decided that they really wanted to launch it at Worldcon up in Montreal. And so that meant that their publishing schedule was going to be compressed to about 8 months.
Wow.
So you got this 2 year light, you know, almost 2 years.
But with a small press, they're not a small press as much as they are an independent press.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think
they were a small press.
I think they've sort of transcended their small press sort of, yeah.
And they now have more, they just launched a new imprint.
Right, yeah, Pugilist. That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah.
No, Nightshade is definitely, they're busy expanding and busy doing interesting things.
Yeah.
And they're nimble. I mean, that's the thing, is that they are, they are still, you know, a relatively, you know, they're one shop, all located in the same space. They do all their work right there. And so they can make a decision like that and say, we're going to roll this book out at Worldcon and really push to make that happen.
Yeah. I had Jacob Weissman My God, Tachyon Press.
Tachyon.
Thank you.
Yeah. It was either Golden Griffin or Tachyon, and you're Tachyon. Yeah.
Who was another person that I literally just ran into in New York and was able to get him on the show quick, and we were talking about the independent press phenomenon that has again resurfaced. That once it was the small press, and now it's the independent press.
Well, it's interesting. What you're seeing is that with Nightshade, I think you're talking about still maybe a 5 or 6 person shop total their whole employee base basically. But what you see with technology is their throw weight is big, and so they punch above their weight class in a lot of ways. I mean, they brought Wind Up Girl out to a national audience and
got quite a bit of accolade and notice for it.
Right. Yeah. And that
accolade, they got quite a bit of
so,
accolade.
Yeah. What's the word? Yeah, they got something.
It's 5:25 in the morning. I'm coining words.
They done got us some nice attention.
There we go.
Exactly.
Yeah. And among that attention was a Hugo nomination for Best Novel, a Nebula win for Best Novel, which is, that's
amazing. I'm still sort of gop-jawed at it.
That right there, if the stories weren't enough, that was a history book thing. And it's also, by the way, not common, is it, for a person to come out with their first book being a book of short stories, to be able to then go on to 2 novels with great success after that. It's not common, is it?
I can't comment, but I'm really happy that it's working out so far.
Yeah.
It's an interesting transition to go from short stories to novels, that's for sure. It's definitely
I'd like to talk about that, but we just need to mention Time Magazine chose this as one of the 10 best books, not science fiction books, 10 best books of 2009.
Yeah, yeah. 10 best novels of the year. Yeah.
Yeah,
that was another sort of...
That should give people an idea of the caliber that we're talking about and transcending genre.
That was really interesting to sort of see Time Magazine embrace the Wind Up Girl that way, because you spend a certain amount of time feeling like the science fiction genre isn't really noticed by the outside world very much, and so to have something like that happen was also it was a huge gift. It was a big surprise, and it was really cool.
So I'm going to ask you the question that drives Ellen Dadlow crazy.
Oh.
I used to do online interviews for her at Omni and later at her website, Event Horizon, and every time I was the host, I was alternating with Ed Bryant, which is very cool.
Yeah.
And, really nice guy. Oh, yeah, yeah. And every time I would ask the interviewee, and I do this on the air, as you're about to be subjected to,
awesome,
the difference between the short form and the long form.
This is easier.
I did this to Mary, who's just coming out with a novel herself.
And everybody says the same thing. They say the long form is longer.
Well, there's that. There's that. And I purposely never frame the question. I don't ask whether it's an artistic question. One of the reasons I love the question is... some people will answer, well, you can't make a living writing short stories.
Right.
Others will talk about, oh, you're polishing a gem and it's all this. And some people spend a lot longer writing 2 short stories than they do a 700-page novel. What I want to do one of these days, if I ever get my interviews in order or my ducks in a row, is I want to go through all those typed online interviews and radio interviews and all that, and just take that one question,
right,
and give so many different people's answer to the difference between the forms.
Right.
Nala Hopkinson gave me an hour on the topic.
Right. Well, it's interesting because, I mean, for me, what the short form really was it was the only way I could get published. I had originally set out to be a novelist. I thought of myself as wanting to be a novelist. I grew up reading my father's science fiction collection. I wanted to write books. There was a period when I didn't think I was, I wasn't really, I didn't, let's see, how do I say that? there was a period after I graduated from college when I was trying to get real jobs and be a real worker and, you know, just sort of be a functional member of society and sort of failing miserably at that. I was very unhappy. I was getting good jobs and I was making good money and I was really miserable. And so I started writing on the side. But when I started writing, it was always with the concept that I was going to try to create a book. It wasn't, I think short form was barely on my map really at that point. And so I wrote my first novel. I was 25 years old or 23 years old or something when I wrote my first novel. And I was really thinking I was going to be the next, you know, sort of wunderkind of writing or something. So awful.
And yet there are people who would probably call you that.
In their dotage,
I should say.
Well, let's put it this way. When I wrote that first novel, I thought it was going to get published. And so, and it didn't. It, in fact, got roundly rejected. And I went on and wrote.
That was then.
Right.
That book may yet come out of the trunk. No,
it can't be done.
Those watching their radio see Paolo going, no.
Well, I think it was actually a really, in terms of the technology extrapolation, I think it was a pretty smart book. I was writing it right as the World Wide Web was really kind of kicking off, and I was working in a web development company, and so this was back in, you know, 96 or something that I'm writing this, and I had, some thoughts about, you know, what implications did this have for privacy? What implications did this have for the way that we conduct our personal lives if you can always be reflected out and echoed in the online sphere? You know, what is this going to do? And so I think they were really interesting ideas for 1996. Fascinating ideas for 1996. Now we have Facebook. And so, you know, the obsolescence of that book, I think, is not...
It's one of the dangers of science fiction.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
No, it was. I think it was sort of, in terms of, I'm not sure whether the plot worked and a bunch of other things, but I think in terms of the technology extrapolation, I was on the right track. But yes, I've since been swept past by real events.
Yeah, unless you said it far. I mean, I remember reading Speaker for the Dead whenever that came out.
Right.
I had Scott Card on the show the day he won the Nebula for that.
Oh, interesting.
And that's a boast I make. I try to get people to believe that if they do the show on the day that they'll win the Nebula Award. It sadly didn't work for William Shun, but he came on anyway.
It was worth a shot.
I got Saladin Ahmed to read his story, but not...
Not on the day.
Not on the day.
See, if it had been on the day, yeah, I see, right.
But on the day, he was in Florida with you.
Indeed, yeah, that was actually the first time I got a chance to meet him.
So yeah.
That was really cool.
Where was I going? And Scott, somehow, when I got online... In the early 80s, I was so self-congratulatory, and I went to various online services like The Source, if anybody remembers The Source. Before that was CompuServe, there was The Source.
Mm.
We're talking late 70s, early 80s. And I was on local BBSs, and everywhere I went, there was somebody online named Uncle Orson.
Right, okay.
And so if you read Speaker for the Dead, you will see that basically much of the framework of the book is about blogging.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, huh. It's about blogging for news and the social network, and it's all in there. This did not yet exist. He was extrapolating from the BBS
mentality.
You can see what's wrong, what's right. And, of course, one of the things that I'm always pointing out to people is they're saying, he predicted that, and it's like, yeah, or did the people who helped develop this read him?
Yeah, no, it's
and bring
interesting.
It there.
Yeah, no, science fiction is really interesting that way, which is sort of, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg kind of questions, you know, that where you know, but there are some examples where you see science fiction really explicitly explicitly inspiring engineering, you know, solutions. You know, you see people like the people who created Half-Life, the people who created Second Life looking back and saying, yes, I wanted to create Neal Stephenson's metaverse. That's what I wanted to do. I liked the idea. I wanted to build it.
Exactly.
Oh, but on the short story topic, though, one of the things that happened was I basically went on and tried to write, like, four different novels. I wrote four novels, and each one of those failed completely, and I couldn't sell any of them. And so I had written one short story by that time, which was Pocket Full of Dharma, and that was the one spot where I'd actually had any success as a writer. And
it's a fabulous story.
That was the one thing that I'd done right, sort of, in my hit by that time. And I thought, well, the door is open there.
And that's sort of the first story in Pump Six, isn't it?
It is.
And a good way to start it.
It's actually the collection is actually arranged chronologically, flat out chronologically. So you can just see exactly what I was publishing as I went along and as my career sort
and
of,
and yet it seems you know, to because there's something about reading. When I first read your work, I was reading it through online, through the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, FNSF, to various places. And then when John Joseph Adams, thank you, John, gave me a copy of Pump Six, and I looked at it in order, even though I was familiar with, I think, every story in there. I saw a different arc.
There's a progression for me as a writer that I feel like, I guess I'm sort of interested in Pump Six because it sort of reflects this process of me first figuring out how to write stories, then figuring out kind of what interests me, and then sort of trying to figure out how to do things with stories to tell very specific kinds of stories, to talk about certain issues that are interesting to me. And so that's been a sort of a process as I've sort of, I think, you know, there's a, you know, if you can talk about writers finding their voice, I think that Pump Six very much reflects that arc of me finding the kinds of things that I want to be writing about and talking about and my obsessions. And also, you know, hopefully I get better as I go along.
Now that you are successful with the long form in publishing it, and more than a little bit, you know, one book being a phenom, and it'll be
Wind Up Girl is doing really well.
It really is, and it's very interesting to see how Shipbreaker is going to do because, you know, crassly speaking, the market is for YA.
Yeah, theoretically.
Scott Westerfeld went from very adult stuff to young adult and became a sensation.
Right. I think
we'll see if John Armstrong goes that way eventually.
Right, exactly.
I'll be having him on the show. I'm forgetting the name of his new book that's going
Yarn.
To Yarn.
Yarn will be coming out. Yeah, that's also a Nightshade title, actually. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
I think.
Yeah, Gray wasn't, but...
No, Gray was Nightshade.
It was Nightshade. Yeah. Okay, I hadn't noticed. I just had him on. So I'll have him on again when Yarn comes out.
Yeah, I could see that, actually. That would be really interesting if he went YA.
yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, have you read Scott's adult science fiction?
I haven't, actually.
Okay,
I've heard it's great stuff.
It is.
I
it really is. Yeah. And, you know, not to put anything against the Uglies and all that stuff that he's doing now, but we know him when.
Right.
You know, before he had a novel published, he was on this show reading his stories. And that's, you know, we were pushing the limits of what the FCC will broadcast.
Right.
And without words, we're talking content.
Right. Yeah, I think, it's kind of interesting, you know, the people say, oh, the YA genre, that's really big, that's where the money is or whatever. And interestingly, for me, right now at least, the real success is actually Wind Up Girl. And and that's where, I mean, I actually have a living. I actually can survive as a writer for the moment because of the way that Wind Up Girl is doing.
Yeah, but Shipbreaker is just being published now by Little Brown, so we'll see where that is in 4 months.
I really just want that book to survive. That's what I really – I mean, but so the thing is you see I think that there are really
– what I'm hoping it will do, by the way, is – bring young readers to Wind Up Girl as well. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, or it's, at least let's not mistake ourselves, Wind Up Girl, at least for that older high school reader, perhaps, yeah.
But people read beyond their
lives. Oh, yeah. No, I have a friend, his son just read all of my stuff, and and, you know, tore through it all and really liked it all. So, I mean, it's all accessible on that
level.
It
is. It really is.
What was the thing I was thinking about? It was something about... the thing about, you know...
I'm great at distracting my guests.
Where you find success is really interesting. I mean, where I sort of feel like there's something very odd and interesting happening with the Wind-Up Girl right now, where it's not... It sort of feels like it maybe is hitting some sort of a zeitgeisty moment. It seems to be hitting... I mean...
Oh, absolutely.
And I can't figure out what that is, and I wonder whether, you know, I mean, Scott Westerfeld writes great stuff in adult science fiction. He writes great stuff in YA. For whatever zeitgeisty reason, you find your spot, and and you know, one piece of success in one area doesn't indicate its piece of success in the other, or vice versa. You know, it just sort of feels like there's a lot more mystery than just, oh, YA is where the money is, and oh, science fiction is a spot where there is no money. I was told the conventional wisdom is that writing, you know, hardcore science fiction is a terrible career plan.
Fantasy is what's really been doing well for the last 20 years. Science fiction
is on the wane. It's what's the point? You know, all that kind of stuff. You know, nobody buys it. Blah blah blah. And
well, it's not true that nobody buys it. It's just that, you know, what people have to find the right thing for themselves. So David Williams. Oh, we have to thank David J. Williams.
We do, actually.
We must.
Thank
we must.
Thank you, David.
Because David had to be postponed from the show because a fundraising drive came at a time when I wasn't expecting it, and I had to postpone him once. Then he was going to be on this morning.
I'm not David Williams.
Yeah, and I emailed him, and he was
I wouldn't mind being David Williams.
Very gracious in rearranging. He'll be on the last Saturday of this month.
So I owe him a thanks because I just sort of, I don't have my ducks in a row ever, and I just came into New York.
Oh, like
and,
I do.
And I'm, yeah, so anyway, I really appreciate that he was willing to adjust around me. So I need to adjust around him at some point here, too.
But he's another example of somebody who's writing hardcore science fiction and doing very well with it and getting lots of critical notice. A positive critical notice, I should say. And I believe a certain amount of commercial success.
Yeah.
So I think it's true that science fiction isn't taking up as much room on shelves in stores, virtual or mortar.
But there is an appetite. And there is an appetite for it. And I think that we sort of get caught up in these sort of generalized stories about what this genre or that genre, what this aspect of the genre is doing.
Something that could not sell would be a story about a young wizard or anything, but that's what created the YA phenomenon.
So, yeah, there's just, I mean, one of the things that's sort of interesting to me right now is that, people describe my writing as dystopian rather than science fiction a lot of times, and that's the palatable term.
It is dystopian, but it is science fiction.
You know, I it's so funny because when I think about dystopia, I just sort of think about this really, I mean, maybe I just really, maybe I just have this really uptight definitional sort of mode, but when I think about dystopia, I think dystopia is one of those, it should be a perfected society that's actually nightmarish, and that's the core of dystopia. It's exactly like utopia. It's a perfected society, except for the experience of the individual is entirely nightmarish, is what dystopia to me is. And, you know, in that sort of 1984 sense, in that Yevgeny Zamyatin sense, you know, that kind of thing where everybody else around you probably doesn't understand why you're not getting on the train and not enjoying it, and you're wrong, and that sort of strikes me as being that's the core of what I think
it's
of dystopia.
Utopian turned upside down,
right?
World turned upside
down. And so, as opposed to sort of a broken future or just trashed out. I mean, if we call something like the Wind-Up Girl dystopia, I mean, then so is. You know, so are the shipbreaking yards of Bangladesh or something. I mean, it's just, some things are just badly organized and humanly cruel. You know, I mean, we just have cruel worlds.
It may be the wrong
word.
We're
cruel people. It's our worst aspects, certainly, but it's not, but, you know, so I sort of wonder about that sometimes, you know. And then Afghanistan is dystopia. And it's like, well, no, it's just a trashed zone, trashed by the standard human behaviors that create trashed places. And so when I write a future that's trashed, you know, I don't necessarily think of that as dystopian, in my mind at least. And so it's sort of an interesting term for me.
Yeah.
But I'm grateful for it because it seems to make people feel like, oh, I can swallow this bitter pill of science fiction so much more easily than I would otherwise.
Yeah. Well, is there a good word? I mean, it's like down, man. Certainly what you're writing, there is hope in it, but it's not cheerful.
Right. Yeah. No. I think of myself as writing stories about which are focused on the consequences of the present, basically,
mm-hmm.
And just running those consequences out. And so I think of them as broken futures.
And I have to say, I wish that books like Shipbreaker were not coming to pass.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting with the Gulf Coast thing. So the background for people who are listening or anything like that. So the
It was a leading question.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No, not sorry. Thank you.
Shipbreaker takes place in the future on the Gulf Coast, and it's all about child laborers tearing apart old oil-burning vessels, old freighters, oil tankers, things like that. And it's these kids are just tearing apart these ships and living terrible lives, basically. And it's modeled on the shipbreaking yards of Chittagong in Bangladesh or Lang in India. So it's a sort of a post-oil, post-global warming future. And the lives of the people on the Gulf Coast are sort of dirty, dangerous, and short. And it's interesting when the Deepwater Horizon thing, Deepwater Horizon blew itself up, I actually thought, it's interesting. I write these terrible futures, and yet it's possible that I'm not writing terrible enough futures.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's interesting. I might not be sufficiently cynical about our future.
Right, because we have this horror, we're having terrible presents and mm-hmm. species of animals, livelihoods, mm-hmm. cities mm-hmm. virtually being wiped out.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, in terms of sort of a strange sort of extinction event occurring right now on the Gulf Coast, it's really interesting. Like, you know, how does this play out long term? We don't even know. I mean, it's just sort of like we're just sort of seeing the beginning of a storyline.
Yeah.
But I sort of thought, wow, I actually could have trashed the Gulf more, apparently.
Yeah.
And probably will in the next book.
There you go, because how do you outdo the Deepwater Horizon?
Yeah, how do you outdo? I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that how do you outdo our casual ability to destroy things? I mean, this isn't even deliberate destruction, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if we destroy Berlin when we have World War II or something like that, you know, at least you knew that you were trying to destroy Berlin.
Yes, right. It's like, yes.
Oh, gee, whoops! You know, some engineer screwed something up on a drill rig, and now we've wiped out, you know, the Gulf Coast or whatever. And, just amazing. The scope of our power is beyond our understanding. I mean, and that's something that's really interesting to me about, you know, when I'm writing science fiction, I'm writing stories about technology. You know, you're saying that our technology has outstripped our ability to understand it. And again, that's something that's interesting to me about writing science fiction stories, is saying we don't understand these technologies. We're monkeys playing with these technologies, and we will inevitably screw up what we're doing with these technologies. The unintended consequences are big. And certainly, I mean, you take an ultra-deep-water drilling platform, and you say, this is an agent of destruction for the Gulf. It's like, no, of course not. You're crazy. You're just some liberal, whiny, you know, hinky-dinky, you know, hippy-skippy-dippy, you know, loser.
Colorado.
Right, exactly. If you say that, you know, who can hate a drill rig, really? I mean, yeah, sure, it can mess up, it can blow up, it can do some things, but we know that, like, we rational people know that this technology isn't that big a deal one way or the other. It turns out it's a big deal. Who knew?
Speaking of liberal hippie dippies, Skippy. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored radio at 99.5 FM. And see, I should do a break every so often and tell people
Absolutely.
That they're listening to Hour of the Wolf over WBAI 99.5 in New York and over WBAI.org. And I am Jim Freund. My guest this morning, Paolo Bacigalupi.
The child of hippies.
That's right. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
In one of your bios. And it's so much fun and so weird for me where I was just barely, I was coming into the WBAI Pacifica environment when I was 13 years old because of the science fiction stuff that was going on here. And when David, I like to tell people, when David Hartwell said, or quoted, I'm not sure which it was, the golden age of science fiction was 13.
Right.
I said, well, that's me. Because when I was 13, I was hanging around Baird Searles here at WBAI, whose hanger-ons were Samuel R. Delaney, and I was witness to them creating a fabulous radio drama by Delaney called The Star Pit, based on his Nebula Award-winning novella. And Ted Sturgeon was here.
Sort of a rock star
stories.
Lineup.
Oh, yeah, Tom Dish. The script girl for a number of Baird Searles' radio dramas, her official title was script girl, was Joanna Russ.
No.
There's a name I don't think a title I don't think is on her CV today, script girl.
Right.
At
WBAI. Yeah, seriously.
I suspect not.
Right.
But the, so I was 13 in 1967, 68, and just, you know, a little bit too young to be a hippie, but to be sort of adopted by the hippies of
WBAI.
And now I'm having folk on the show, China Mieville, yourself, people are saying, oh yeah, I'm the raised by hippies.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Which leads for a different, view of science fiction. And he's another person who writes very dark, who's writing
China.
I would say that some
fabulous
of his writing
yeah.
is, oh, I love The City in the City. Another, I guess was that last year's 2008's Phenom novel, and yours is 2009.
City
is
in
fair?
The City. We're in the running together for everything.
Oh, you were in the running together.
Yeah, no,
okay.
We were in the running. We're in for, the running for the Nebulas.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I actually was. I was actually convinced that he was going to win.
That was actually. So, I would say actually that was a neck and neck.
I was certain that he.
No,
was
no,
going
but
to
no,
win.
But no. Everybody had their money on you.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't. I had my money on him. I was, yeah. No, that was.
He would have been worthy, I have to say.
I was perfectly happy to lose to him. I had it already planned in my head. So,
yeah.
We're up in
but
the
But it's just interesting. You're both
well.
A child, both raised by hippies. He got his name that way through Cockney rhyming slang.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. Well, I'll find it for you at some point, but I had him on the air talking about how he got his name, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
So, but it, basically, it's like China is your best dish, and he was the best this or
right,
that.
Right,
so
right.
They so that that's how they came up with it. It was Cockney rhyming slang.
Interesting.
Just fabulous stuff. I need to ask you about how long your reading is going to be.
I think it's going to be fairly short. I think it'll be about a half an hour long.
So. Okay. So we should probably actually account for that because we're approaching 6 a.m.
Right.
And we'll take a cut of music as an audio sorbet.
Yeah.
As it were. And I'm sure that I asked you about 8 questions that I didn't allow you to answer. But
we can loop back after I read, maybe.
So. Yeah, we can do that. So we'll be bow. I should choose a song. Oh, here's one at random that I think we'll do just for the title, if nothing else. The Coon Sanders Nighthawks is one of the great bands of the 20s and 30s.
Nice.
And the cut is Dreaming of Tomorrow.
Thank you.
We are back.
We're back. All right.
I've okay. So this. Again. So let me tell people again that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM, and at
wait,
WBAI.
We have to stop and go back to that part about listener-sponsored.
Yes.
Non-commercial public radio.
Awesome. Not public radio. Oh, not public.
Sorry.
A lot of people on the station get that wrong.
Oh, interesting.
But we are the Pacifica Foundation,
okay.
A nonprofit educational
private.
Institution operating radio stations out of. Yes, we're a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
We're a private foundation taking listener sponsored very seriously. Public means government owned and run.
Interesting. Interesting.
That's what public means. It's the definition of public radio, public television, part of the government.
Interesting.
College radio is not public radio, and Pacifica radio is not public radio.
Interesting.
That's the difference. Now, I'm not saying that public radio isn't cool and good.
That's interesting, because I think, because I'm trying to think of, we have a little station in our hometown, in my hometown, called KVNF. And we describe ourselves as public radio. I'm trying to think, like, how...
They may subscribe, they may be a member of public radio.
We are members of public radio.
And they may very well get government grants.
Right.
And government money that makes them public radio.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting thing. I'm not sure.
But what we are all together is we're all NFCB. We're all part of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters.
Oh, there it
is. An organization that nobody remembers.
Right, right.
But it's actually extremely cool.
Uh-huh.
But but listener-sponsored, non-commercial. We invented it. That's true, 1947.
Very cool. I'm sorry, I messed up your call sign stuff, so if you want
it's fine. We're not even doing a proper legal station break for another minute and a half.
Oh, really?
But,
okay.
Because it's 5:58 and a half. Assuming that clock is correct, I should actually check my Murph to see if it has a similar... they match!
It's
like our clock here is accurate. Wow, how unusual is that?
Right.
My guest, I should say, though, that the show is Hour of the Wolf, and my name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, Paolo Bacigalupi, and we should finally, by the way, spell your name so that people can... now, if you want the website, that's Wind Up Stories.
Right. WindUpStories.com is my website.
Correct.
And we use WindUpStories.com because writing PaoloBacigalupi.com would be a nightmare.
But we do want to spell it for people nonetheless. Paolo, Paolo, and then Bacigalupi, Bacigalupi.
Perfect. Yeah, but most people don't want to do that. So we use windupstories.com for access, and that way I can say something that people will actually remember on the air.
But the point of that is I mean, people want to go to the website, of course, but if they want to go to the bookstore.
If you want to try to find me, it's Bacigalupi, Bacigalupi. I used to say that when I was like 3 years old. I used to do it in a sing-song, Baciga. And because I'd listen to my mother saying it all the time to people at the bank and things like that.
Yeah, people never get my name, Freund, and they're Freund.
Right.
Some do friend, and there are people who pronounce my name.
Right.
I mean, they are named Freund, but they say friend. And then some people change their name to Forsyth, John Forsyth.
Right.
Who just passed away. John Freund.
Ah.
His name was John Freund.
Interesting.
Came out in his in his obit.
I was really grateful, actually, when I won the Nebula that John Scalzi actually pronounced my name correctly. It was quite awesome because...
Well, he should and would, you know.
He knew me and stuff, but it had been sort of a running joke through the rest of the Nebulas that people would run into that name, and it was just a train wreck right from the start.
Oh, God, I have to...
It is a train wreck name. I mean, it's just what it is.
I mean, I had a moment the first time that I saw it and I said, oh, thank God I'm not going to have this guy on the radio.
Right, exactly.
Because, but it's actually, it's phonetic. You can take a look at the name and it's easy to pronounce if you just get over it.
Right, yeah. No, once you stop looking at all the vowels and going, what? Why is that happening to me?
Yeah, I had a Thai friend with a long, long name and I took a look at that name and then it's like, Rednarathorn.
Right.
It's so simple.
Except for the tones, which you're probably missing. So
I probably am, but he had a very strong Bronx accent.
Oh, well, there you go.
I think it was Bronx, but anyway. So, oh, now we've passed the break time. I've wasted so much. It's after 6 a.m., so we'll say again, WBAI, New York, thereby appeasing the FCC. You're going to read for us?
I am going to read for us. This is actually one of my shorter stories. Mostly I write novelettes. And so this is actually the first time I ever tried to write a short story. This is a story called Small Offerings, which
it's a fine story.
Which first appeared in Fast Forward 1, from which was an anthology edited by Lou Anders. And he actually approached me. This was the first time I ever wrote a story on where I'd been invited to submit a story to an anthology. And Lou had approached me at World Fantasy Convention and said, I've already oversubscribed this book. There's too many people already. But, you know, if you wanted to be in it and you can write a story in 3,000 words, I'll shoehorn you in. And this was very early on, and I was very flattered. So I sat down and I said, okay, well, I got to figure out how to write these real short stories. And trying to do something at 3,000 words when I'm used to writing at 10 or 11,000 words or 12,000 words was sort of an interesting sort of experiment for me.
And don't mind me when you start reading. I just realized I got my little
camera. Oh boy, you got a camera.
Cisco owned camera. Excellent. So I'm going to just set that up because it's cool.
All right. I won't mind that red eye staring at me while I read this. All right. So this is Small Offerings. And the other thing you as listeners have to bear with is that this is actually a female protagonist, female narrator, and so you're going to have to imagine me as though I'm a woman instead of a man. So I'm going to try to change my voice a little bit for that, but my coffee and asthma may be fighting us. Small Offerings. Readouts glow blue on drip lines where they burrow into Maya Ong's spine. She lies on the birthing table, her dark eyes focused on her husband, while I sit on a stool between her legs and wait for her baby. There are two halves of Maya. Above the blue natal sheet, she holds her husband's hand and sips water and smiles tiredly at his encouragement. Below it, hidden from view and hidden from sensation by steady surges of Sifusoft, her body lies nude, her legs strapped into birthing stirrups. Pernate hits her belly in rhythmic bursts, pressing the fetus down her birth canal and toward my waiting hands. I wonder if God forgives me for my part in her prenatal care, forgives me for her encouraging this full course of treatment. I touch my belt remote and thumb up another 50 milliliters of pernate. The readouts flicker and display the new dose as it hisses into Maya's spine and works its way around to her womb. Maya inhales sharply, then lies back and relaxes, breathing deeply as I muffle her pain response in swaddling layers of Sifusoft. Ghostly data flickers and scrolls at the perimeter of my vision. Heart rate, blood pressure, oxygenation, fetal heart rate, all piped directly to my optic nerve by my Medassist implant. Maya cranes her neck around to see me. Dr. Mendoza? Lily? Her words slur under the drugs, come out slow and dreamy. Yes? I can feel it kicking. My neck prickles. I force a smile. They're natal phantasms, illusions generated by the gestation process. No, Maya shakes her head, emphatic. I feel it. It's kicking. She touches her belly. I feel it now. I come around the natal sheet and touch her hand. It's all right, Maya. Let's just relax. I'll see what we can do to keep you comfortable. Ben leans down and kisses his wife's cheek. You're doing great, honey. Just a little longer. I give her hand a reassuring pat. You're doing a wonderful thing for your baby. Let's just relax now and let nature take its course. Maya smiles dreamily in agreement and her head rolls back. I let out a breath I hadn't known I was holding and start to turn away. Maya lurches upright. She stares at me, suddenly alert, as if all the birthing drugs have been lifted off her like a blanket, leaving her cold and awake and aggressive. Her dark eyes narrow with madness. You're going to kill it. Uh-oh. I thumb my belt unit for the orderlies. She grabs Ben by the shoulder. Don't let her take it. It's alive, honey. Alive. Honey, she yanks him close. Don't let her take our baby. She turns and snarls at me. Get out. Get out. She lunges for a water glass on her bedside table. Get out. She flings it at me. I duck, and it shatters against the wall. Glass shards pepper my neck. I get ready to dodge another attack, but instead, Maya grabs the natal sheet and yanks it down, exposing her nude lower half splayed for birth. She claws at her birthing stirrups like a wolf in a trap. I spin the dials on my belt remote, jam up her perne, and shut off her Sifusoft as she throws herself against the stirrups again. The birthing table tilts alarmingly. I lunge to catch it. She flails at me, and her nails gouge my face. I jerk away, clutching my cheek, wave at her husband, who's standing dumbly on the opposite side of the birthing table, staring, "Help me hold her!" He snaps out of his paralysis. Together, we wrestle her back onto the table, and then a new contraction hits, and she sobs and curls in on herself. Without Sifusoft, there's nothing to hide the birth's intensity. She rocks against the pain, shaking her head and moaning, small and beaten. I feel like a bully, but I don't restart the painkillers. She moans, "Oh God, oh God, oh God." Benjamin puts his head down beside her, strokes her face. "It's okay, honey. It's going to be fine." He looks up at me, hoping for confirmation. I make myself nod. Another pernate-induced contraction hits. They're coming fast now, her body completely in the grip of the overdose I flushed into her. She pulls her husband close and whispers, "I don't want this, honey. Please. It's a sin." Another contraction hits, less than 20 seconds apart. Two thick-armed female orderlies draped in friendly pink blouses finally come thumping through the door and move to restrain her. The cavalry always arrives too late. Maya brushes at them weakly until another contraction hits. Her naked body arches as the baby begins its final passage into our world. The pretty queen of the hypocritical oath arrives. Dimitri sits amongst his brood, my sin and my redemption bound in one gaunt and sickly man. His shoulders rise and fall with labored asthmatic breathing. His cynical blue eyes bore into me. "You're bloodied." I touch my face, come away with wet fingers. A patient went natal. All around us, Dimitri's test subjects scamper, shrieking and warring, an entire tribe of miscalibrated humanity, all gathered together under Dimitri's care. If I key in patient numbers on my belt unit, I get medicist laundry lists of pituitary misfires, adrenal tumors, sexual malformations, attention and learning disorders, thyroid malfunctions, IQ falloffs, hyperactivity, and aggression. An entire ward full of poster children for chemical legislation that never finds its way out of government committee. "Your patient went natal." Dimitri's chuckle comes as a slow wheeze. Even in this triple-filtered air of the hospital's chemical intervention ward, he barely takes enough oxygen to stay alive. What a surprise! Emotion trumps science once again. His fingers drum compulsively on the bed of an inert child beside him, a 5-year-old with the breasts of a grown woman. His eyes flick to the body and back to me. No one seems to want prenatal care these days, do they? Against my will, I blush. Dimitri's mocking laughter rises briefly before dissolving into coughing spasms that leave him keeled over and gasping. He wipes his mouth on his lab coat sleeve and studies the resulting bloody smear. You should have sent her to me. I could have convinced her. Beside us, the girl lies like a wax dummy, staring at the ceiling. Some bizarre cocktail of endocrine disruptors has rendered her completely catatonic. The sight of her gives me courage. Do you have any more squeegees? Dimitri laughs, sly and insinuating. His eyes flick to my damaged cheek. And what would your sharp-nailed patient say if she found out? Please, Dimitri, don't. I hate myself enough already. I'm sure. Caught between your religion and your profession. I'm surprised your husband even tolerates your work. I look away. He prays for me. Well, God solves everything, I understand. Don't. Dimitri smiles. It's probably what I've missed in my research. We should all just beg God to keep babies from absorbing their mother's chemical sludge. With a little Sunday prayer, Lily, you can go back to pushing folate and vitamins. Problem solved. He stands abruptly, coming to his full 6.5 feet like a spider unfolding. Come on, let's consummate your hypocrisy before you change your mind. I couldn't bear it if you decided to rely on your faith. Inside Dimitri's lab, fluorescent lights glare down on stainless steel countertops and test equipment. Dimitri rustles through the drawers one after another, searching. On the countertop before him, a gobbet of flesh lies marooned, wet and incongruous on the sterile gleaming surface. He catches me staring at it. You will not recognize it. You must imagine it smaller. One portion is larger than an eyeball. The rest is slender, a dangling subsection off the main mass. Meat and veiny, fatty gunk. Dimitri rustles through another drawer. Without looking up, he answers his own riddle. A pituitary gland. From an 8-year-old female. She had terrible headaches. I suck in my breath. Even for Kemint, it's a freak of nature. Dimitri smiles at my reaction. 10 times oversized. Not from a vulnerable population, either. Excellent prenatal care, good filter mask practices, low pesticide food sources. We're losing our battle, I think. He opens another drawer. Ah, here. He pulls out a foil-wrapped square the size of a condom, stamped in black and yellow, and offers it to me. My trials have already recorded the doses dispensed. It shouldn't affect the statistics. He nods at the flesh gobbet. And certainly, she won't miss it. The foil is stamped not for sale, along with a tracking number and the intertwined DNA and microscope icon of the FDA Human Trials Division. I reach for it, but Dimitri pulls it away. Put it on before you leave. It has a new backing. Cellular foil. Trackable. You can only wear it inside the hospital. He tosses me the packet, shrugs apologetically. Our sponsors think too many doses are walking away. How long do I need to wear it before I can leave? 3 hours will give you most of the dose. Enough? Who knows? Who cares? Already you avoid the best treatment. You reap what you sow. I don't have a retort. Dimitri knows me too well to feed him the stories I tell myself, the ones that comfort me at 3 a.m. when Justin's asleep and I'm staring at the ceiling, listening to his steady, honest breathing. It's for our marriage. It's for our future. It's for our baby. I strip off the backing, untuck my blouse, and unbutton my slacks. I slip the derm down under the waistband of my panties. As it attaches to my skin, I imagine clean, cleansing medicine flowing into me. For all his taunts, Dimitri has given me salvation, and suddenly I'm overwhelmed with gratitude. We owe you, Dimitri, really. We couldn't have waited until the trial's finished. Dimitri grunts acknowledgement. He's busy prodding the dead girl's bloated pituitary. You could never have afforded it anyway. It's too good for everyone to have. The squeegee hits me on the L. 1 minute, I'm sitting and smiling at the kids across the aisle with their Hello Kitty and their Burn Girl filter masks, and the next minute, I'm doubled over, ripping off my own mask and gagging. The girls stare at me like I'm a junkie. Another wave of nausea hits, and I stop caring what they think. I sit doubled over on my seat, trying to keep my hair out of my face and vomiting on the floor between my shoes. By the time I reach my stop, I can barely stand. I vomit again on the platform, going down on hands and knees. I have to force myself not to crawl down from the L. Even in the cold winter, I'm sweating. The crowds part around me, boots and coats and scarves and filter masks, glittering news chips and men's sideburns and women with braided microfilament glow strands stepping around me, laughing with silver lipsticks. Kaleidoscope streets, lights and traffic and dust and cold diesel exhaust, muddy and wet. My face is wet. I can't remember if I've fallen in the murk of a curb or if this is my vomit. I find my apartment by luck, manage to stand until the elevator comes. My wrist implant radios open the apartment's locks. Justin jumps up as I open the door. Lily? I retch again, but I've left my stomach on the street. I wave him away and stumble for the shower, stripping off my coat and blouse as I go. I curl into a ball on the cold white tiles while the shower warms. Fumble with the straps on my bra. I can't work the catch. I gag again, shuddering as the squeegee rips through me. Justin's socks are standing beside me. The black pair with the hole in the toe. He kneels. His hands touch my bare back. What's wrong? I turn away, afraid to let him see my filthy face. What do you think? Sweat covers me. I'm shivering. Steam has started pouring up from the tiles. I push aside the cotton shower curtain and crawl in, letting the water soak my remaining clothes. Hot water pours over me. I finally drag off my bra, let it drag on the puddled tiles. This can't be right. He reaches in to touch me, but pulls away when I start gagging again. The retching passes. I can breathe. It's normal. My words whisper out. My throat is raw with vomit. I don't know if he hears me or not. I pry off my soggy slacks and underwear, sit on the tiles, let the water pour over me, let my face press against one tiled wall. Dimitri says it's normal. Half the subjects experience nausea. It doesn't affect efficacy. I start retching again, but it's not as bad now. The wall feels wonderfully cool. You don't have to do this, Lily. I roll my head around, try to see him. You want a baby, don't you? Yeah, but... Yeah. I press my face against the tile again. If we're not doing prenatal, I don't have a choice. The squeegee's next wave is hitting me. I'm sweating. I'm suddenly so hot I can't breathe. Every time is worse than the last. I should tell Dimitri for his trial data. Justin tries again. Not all natural babies turn out bad. We don't even know what these drugs are doing to you. I force myself to stand, lean against the wall and turn up the cold water. I fumble for the soap, drop it, leave it lying by the drain. Clinicals in Bangladesh, they were good, better than before. FDA could approve now if they wanted. I'm panting with the heat. I open my mouth and drink unfiltered water from the showerhead. It doesn't matter. I can almost feel PCBs and dioxins and phthalates gushing out of my pores and running off my body. Goodbye, hormone mimics. Hello, healthy baby. You're insane. Justin lets the shower curtain fall into place. I shove my face back into the cool spray. He won't admit it, but he wants me to keep doing this. He loves that I'm doing this for him. For our kids. Our kids will be able to spell and to draw a stick figure, and I'm the only one who gets dirty. I can live with that. I swallow more water. I am burning up. Fueled by the overdose of pernate, the baby arrives in minutes. The mucky hair of a newborn shows and recedes. I touch the head as it crowns. You're almost there, Maya. Again, a contraction. The head emerges into my hands, a pinched old man's face protruding from Maya's body like a golem from the earth. Another two pushes, and it spills from her. I clutch the slick body to me as an orderly snips the umbilical cord. The Medisys data on his heart rate flickers red at the corner of my vision. Flatlines. Maya is staring at me. The natal screen is down. She can see everything we wish prenatal patients would never see. Her skin is flushed. Her black hair clings sweaty to her face. Is it a boy or a girl? I'm frozen, crucified by her gaze. I duck my head. It's neither. I turn and let the bloody wet mass slip out of my hands and into the trash. Perfume hides the iron scent that has blossomed in the air. Down in the canister, the baby is curled in on itself, impossibly small. Is it a boy or a girl? Ben's eyes are so wide he looks like he'll never blink again. It's okay, honey. It wasn't either. That's for the next one. You know that. Maya looks stricken. But I felt it kick. The blue placental sac spills out of her. I dump it in the canister with the baby and shut down Maya's pernate. Pitocin has already cut off what little bleeding she has. The orderlies cover Maya with a fresh sheet. I felt it, she says. It wasn't dead at all. It was alive. A boy. I felt him. I thumb up a round of Dilaudil. She falls silent. One of the orderlies wheels her out as the other begins straightening the room. She resets the natal screen and the sockets over the bed. Ready for the next patient. I sit beside the biohazard bin with my head between my legs and breathe. Just breathe. My face burns with the slashes of Maya's nails. Eventually, I make myself stand and carry the bio bin over to the waste chute and crack it open. The body lies curled inside. They always seem so large when they pour from their mothers, but now, in its biohazard can, it's tiny. It's nothing, I tell myself. Even with its miniature hands and squinched face and little penis, it's nothing. Just a vessel for contaminants. I killed it within weeks of conception with a steady low dose of neurotoxins to burn out its brain and paralyze its movements while it developed in the womb. It's nothing. just something to scour the fat cells of a woman who sits at the top of a poison food chain and who wants to have a baby. It's nothing. I lift the canister and pour the body into suction. It disappears, carrying the chemical load of its mother down to incineration. An offering. A floppy sacrifice of blood and cells and humanity, so that the next child will have a future.
Paolo Bacigalupi, reading Small Offerings. This is Natalie Merchant.
Footsore and weary, I must tramp on through the winter night. Dreary, you'll fall asleep, pretty baby. Warm on my shoulder while snow falls upon me. Colder and colder.
Natalie Merchant from her new album. Can I remember the name of her new album? Because I'm dealing with radio here. Yes, it's Leave Your Sleep. I thought a lullaby was appropriate after Small Offerings. Offering, singular.
Small Offerings, plural.
It is plural. Yeah. Read for you by the author, Paolo Bacigalupi. If you want to read that in text, it is a small offering at tor.com.
Yeah, actually.
Actually, right now, it's available there. So if you're listening to this archive, or if you want to listen, or if you want to just read a text later, so you can read it over breakfast. That seems
that's a nice. You know, this is a nice morning story.
It's a good appetizing piece. There, you can do so at Tor.com, where they are really turning Tor.com into an online magazine, doing a really great job with it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff happening there. Actually.
Yeah, there really is.
Yeah.
I'll have to have Liz back on the show to talk about that. But let me tell you that this right here is WBAI in New York, and we're broadcasting radio. Remember radio at 99.5 FM? But okay, we're also on WBAI.org, and there are people around the world who listen, which is always thrilling me. And my guest this morning, Paolo Bacigalupi, who you just heard read that remarkable. Which awards did that one win?
You know, that one actually sort of stealthed in and stealthed out, and
ooh,
so it was
okay.
It
too
was
late.
Yeah. It was. It came in because it was in the Fast Forward anthology. It really
right.
It only showed up once, and then it actually got tucked away inside of the Pump Six's signed limited edition, actually, which was only 100 copies. Ooh. And so that's the only spots it's really been, and so now it's sort of having this second lease on life.
Given that the non-limited edition out of print at the moment is selling for between $300 and $400.
Right. Yeah,
if you don't believe me, folks, go to Amazon and look Paolo up.
Yeah, I have no idea what the signed limited is worth.
Yeah. So it's
all subjective. It's just pages. It's just pages.
But, yeah, you know, right.
That story has actually sort of disappeared a little bit, and I'm a little I actually sort of jumped at the opportunity to read it here because endocrine disruptors and chemical pollution are sort of things that I'm always fascinated by, and I live with this.
It's a great radio story, actually.
Yeah, it actually seems to work pretty well for time and stuff like that.
And also for being first person narrative.
Yeah.
And
even if I have to pretend to be a woman, it goes okay. I'd rather have Mary read that. I'd love to have Mary Robinette Cole read that or something.
Well,
that would be awesome.
We can arrange that.
So, because I bet she'd do a great job with it.
Oh, she would. She would.
But
then you'd have to read one of her stories.
Right. But I'd mess that up. So,
nah. And you're a good reader, by the way.
Thanks. That story, actually, there's a woman named Theo Colburn who lives in the same small town that I live in Colorado, and she actually is one of the pioneer researchers into endocrine disruptors, which are artificial chemicals that mimic hormones in the human body and have all sorts of interesting, physiological and developmental effects.
Yeah.
So she's talking with Theo is probably one of the most depressing and awful things you can ever do because all she's got is she sits on top of this huge database of information about all the different research that's being done on endocrine disruptors. And it's scary. And it's just really horrifying. And every once in a while, something that she says like, oh, you need to worry about bisphenol A. It's a terrible drug. It's a terrible chemical. It's, in all these places. And then, 10 years later, you finally see some legislation coming out trying to, get bisphenol A out of baby bottles and out of, things like that. And you're like, oh, Theo was right. Nuts. And you keep hoping she's wrong and she's never wrong. It's really depressing. So.
Yeah. It's also interesting to see how when information like that reaches a writer, a person. I mean, I'm thinking, what would Terry Bisson have done with that same information?
Exactly.
He'd have written a comedy.
Right, exactly. And, the ways that we go after these stories.
An extremely dark comedy and less
but no,
appetizing.
But he would do something completely different with the same thing. And, use that launch point and then whatever the predilections of the writer are can send you in all sorts of different directions.
There's a horrible idea for an anthology. Somebody should do it. Think about take some really horrible little thing like that,
right,
and pass it around,
right? Yeah, just as a small, as the launch point,
launch point, and see how the different. It would be a fascinating exercise, actually.
Yeah, give it to some science fiction writers, and also give it to some fantasy writers, and then see what happens. Like,
totally. And but they'll all end up being horror stories.
Maybe.
Whether it's comedy, whether
might be
it's
heartwarming.
Whatever.
I mean, we're all becoming stupider, and maybe that's a good thing for the world.
I think it'd be. If you, the listener, would like to call up and speak with Paolo Bacigalupi, you are welcome to do so by dialing 212-209-2900. We have one rule: be relevant. In other words, you're not calling to talk about the WBAI elections or anything like that. If you are calling about that, feel free. I'm very good at cutting people off the air if needs be. But you know what I haven't done? My God, I haven't promoted Tuesday.
Ah.
I started to eight times. Yeah, I mentioned Saladin Ahmed.
Right, yeah.
And Saladin's been on this show. Will be back. He'll actually be back. I'll have the whole crew, his entire writer's group.
Oh, really?
Altered Fluid. Cool. Yeah, this is the thing that I do twice a year is I get his entire writer's group, which includes, Tempest Bradford Aliyah Dawn Johnson
and Kate
Jemison.
All
these people come on at once in this room. One of them reads a first draft.
Oh, really?
Of a story.
Well, that's brave.
Isn't
that's,
it?
That's
Isn't
really
it?
Brave.
This
yeah,
is
yeah,
my
yeah,
version
yeah, yeah,
of
yeah,
a horrifying
yeah.
reality
no,
show.
No, that's fantastic,
And then
though,
the others critique it live on the
air. Oh, my goodness. Right. Okay.
I mean, that's really...
Oh, yeah. That's really interesting.
And it's fascinating. It's utterly fascinating.
Yeah,
We've
yeah.
done
Great
five
window
of
into
these.
Craft. It would
yeah.
be a fabulous
So our
window.
Next reader will be Kay Tempest Bradford.
Okay, yeah.
And she's braving
Awesome.
The thing, Saladin.
I'm so jealous that they've got this group in New York. I mean, one of the things about living in
it. We have a few groups here.
Well, I mean, sure, because you've got people here. I mean, where I live, you know, I've got 1,500 people in my town, right? You know, it's a tiny town, you know. This microscopic town in western Colorado. And so, you know, my writer's group consists of, you know, I have one good friend who's a writer. And so we sometimes walk around the block talking to each other about, you know, some problem that we're trying to figure out about writing. But, you know, that's pretty much the sum total of my
Mary Robin Cowell's writer's group is here in New York.
Oh, really? Okay.
And and she used to, when she lived
now she's
here,
in Portland.
She was
right?
a part of, yes, but she's continuing. She
really?
Left the group when she moved to Portland, and she's coming back. They're going, I don't know whether they're going to speakerphone or whatever. Uh-huh. You could join
you
that
could
same
Skype
group.
In or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. what they're going to be doing.
Interesting.
And my partner, she is in that same group.
Oh,
and,
wow. Oh, wow.
And Richard Bowes and Bob Howe, William Shun used to be in that group when he lived in New York.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
okay.
It's now Tabula Rasa.
Okay.
The name of that group. I've had them at the NIRSF, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, on Moss.
Oh, that was what we were doing. We were actually promoting, wasn't
we're
that right?
We're promoting.
Saladin Ahmed, Nebula nominee, newly minted Nebula nominee.
Yes, another rising writer, no
doubt.
Yeah, for sure. Neat guy.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
It's a privilege to meet him, actually, down at the Nebula. He's really cool.
And you.
And me. The two of us
yes.
together.
And John Joseph Adams arranged this by getting Paolo here, and I chose Saladin as the co-reader. And thank you, John. I yelled at him because I was going to be your premier. I was going to have you, this was going to be your first reading in New York. And then you did a reading on Thursday of McNally Jackson books.
It was only a very short one.
It was a short reading. Okay. So we're getting the first, like, really cool reading of
Yeah, super duper cool.
Yeah. But the point is, first or not, it's great. Everybody listening. Everybody listening should come. This is
absolutely.
Still mass media.
Absolutely.
We can hold about 50. So everybody listening should show up. Admission is free. We do ask for donations so we can buy drinks and dinner for our two readers. That's why we ask the donations. And I'll be serving cider and cheese. We go out to you. I was reading people's Twitter tweets about how you all went on a bender after the last reading.
It was only a mini bender.
We
didn't go until like 4 a.m. or anything like that.
Okay. Yeah, well after the reading, we all, and that includes you listeners, by the way, we all go to a nearby pub where they serve nice food, and we eat and drink afterward. But we'll take
drink and socialize.
Exactly.
Awesome.
That's the idea. So if you want to hear Saladin Ahmed, Paolo Bacigalupi read this coming Tuesday, please come to the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading. Okay, I'm going to look at my own press release. The Soho Gallery for Digital Art, proprietor John Ordover. He likes it when I say that. 138 Sullivan Street is the location. It's Sullivan Street between Prince and Houston. Admission is free. We ask for donations for the purposes mentioned, but admission is free. And for more information, send me an email. That's basically it. jim@ourwolf.com. HOURWOLF. And if you want, by the way, you can also ask me to be on the mailing list for that reading series. But our season is over as of June, which is why we're doing one on July 6th.
Yeah.
Actually, just because Paula was here. And again, thank you, John Joseph Adams, for arranging this. He's the publicist through Nightshade Books. And thank you, Ames O'Neill at Little Brown.
Yeah.
So the two of them have conspired to make this happen. We'll take some calls. Good morning. You are on the radio.
Good morning, Jim Friend. This is Bobson from Bulgaria.
How are you?
Wow.
Right. I've been enjoying your show today.
I know. I kept saying you were from the wrong place. You sent me an email, and rightfully so.
Oh, you received the email.
I did, but I didn't get a chance to respond. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I was wondering if it got to you because it's a slightly different address I got from your
dysfunctional
the website that you
My website is still current. But I'll get any emails that are sent to ourwolf.com.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. And I wanted to thank you about the great shows you've been doing lately, but I've been unable to get in touch with you by phone or whatever.
Well, thank you. And so you're doing Skype, are you?
No, it's VoIP of some sort with a phone card that I use by my landline or what's left of it anyhow.
Oh, that's great.
I wanted to congratulate your guest today, Paulo, and I won't even try and pronounce his last name because I don't want to offend.
No worries.
I wanted to congratulate him on his recent Nebula win and various other awards that he may or may not have won in the meantime.
Thank you so much.
I read a short piece of yours maybe a year and a half or two ago in Asimov's magazine, and it was different, and it was well-researched, and I enjoyed it very much. And then afterwards, it got nominated for some of the big awards. I'm not remember the name, but I remember it was from the Wind Up Girl universe, if I should say this.
Then
I saw the books coming out from the same place, and I haven't been able to get my hands on them yet, but I am looking forward to reading those books, and I wish you all the great stuff that's coming your way.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much. Yeah, that was probably Yellow Card Man was what you'd read in Asimov.
Yes,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Great story.
In a while.
Yeah, no, that was a chance for me to write a character study. I was still trying to figure out how to write the Wind-Up Girl, and I wasn't really sure yet how to do it, and so I just wanted to work with just one of the characters and sort of do some backstory.
Well, when I saw the title on your blog or somebody else's blog of your new novel, I was like, hey, that's from the same place that the Yellow Card Man was.
Yep.
So it might be fun.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure it is, but hasn't gotten to me yet.
My distribution in Bulgaria is probably thin still, so.
Well, it's not just yours. It's a bit.
It's the state of things in Bulgaria?
What?
The being able to get books, is that easy enough?
Well, I wouldn't say it's easy, but if you pester enough people long enough, it will get things done.
Okay.
Well, I hope a book gets to you eventually. If it doesn't, I don't know if you get online or not, but there is also an e-book version of it at webscriptions.net that you can get for relatively cheap. And so sometimes just don't like to read on their computers and stuff, but that's the other way
to deal with that. I have a decent e-book reading device
I've spoken with Jim about.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow. So that's
great
the
show
other.
Today. Great shows of the past couple, 3 months that you hadn't heard from me. And a great interview with Frank Herbert from the 70s, which was...
Oh, neat.
Wow.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if...
I'm also going to have to rebroadcast my Clifford Simak interview, which was another really cool one.
Wow, that would be really interesting. Yeah.
If you do, please give, maybe 2 weeks advanced warning so I don't miss the...
Okay, or I'll shoot you an email, okay? I've got your address.
That's good, too. Thanks for all the great work you do, and both of you, I mean. And I'm looking forward to meeting you someday somewhere.
That will be great. I'd love that.
Very cool. Take care.
You too.
Good morning. Or afternoon morning. In your case.
Right.
Okay. I can't get over that getting calls from Bulgaria.
That's pretty magical, actually.
Isn't it?
Yeah. No, it's truly awesome. Yeah.
It is. And good morning. You were on... Oops, no, that didn't work. Yes, you are on the radio. How are you?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Monroe.
On
topic, remember.
About the story, I'm very relevant today.
Good.
I had the feeling it was about a birth of a baby. And then all of a sudden, I have this terrible awareness that it's a stillbirth. A baby born dead.
Yeah.
And it's, but I mean, as far as science fiction, I feel it was a very intimate examination of the process and so forth. I didn't understand the taking of the shower part as whether that happened after or what, but it seemed maybe it was just imagined at that time. But I have to admit, I feel terrible. But I figured you read it because we are in the moment of the birth of our nation. And I must tell you...
Nice metaphor, Monroe.
But let me just say a couple of things. One, I all of a sudden realized that I didn't see among the listed of the signers of the Declaration of Independence George Washington's name. And so then
he's
I
not a framer,
Google,
he was a general.
Yeah, he was in the military, so he wasn't in the social world of the delegates.
He was busy, yeah.
Well, yes, but let me just say this.
But let's get back to Powell.
Yeah, but let me just say this. He could have signed at a later date. As I mean, after all, he defended...
You're saying he was slacking. That's what you're really saying. He was kind of slack, wasn't he?
He wasn't a member and never was of those political circles. He was later appointed president.
Yeah, but I'm saying he could have signed it as an honorary participant in their act.
Well, great documentary with John Adams about John Adams HBO with...
Docudrama. It was fabulous.
Let me just finish, if I may. It is quick. Five of the signers were caught by the British military. They were tortured and they were killed. And the others fled, and their farms and everything were destroyed, and so on and so forth. So I'm more aware today than I ever was about the founding of this country. And I only wish this country wasn't being as bad as it is, if you know what I mean.
Well, that sort of fits with a lot of Paolo's writing, is that you read it and you say, gee, I wish things weren't as bleak as his writing, but they are.
Yeah, unfortunately. But we have to change that, for God's sake. Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe in socialism when it works.
Okay.
Okay, carry on. Thank
Have you. A good morning, Monroe.
I hope I was
Cheers.
Relevant.
Have a good one.
Yes, you were. Okay. Cheers. Okay. And hi there. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Now, before I get to the good Mr. Bacigalupi, I have a piece of news for you. It's interesting. You mentioned Cockney rhyming slime.
Mm-hmm. Because talking about China Mieville's name.
Yes, I read a galley that the book won't be out till early next year. It's called What a Mouth, What a Mouth, What a Mouth, What a North and South, and it's a whole history of Cockney rhyming slime.
Yeah.
And it's
Oxford has one also, yeah.
Yes, but this one is updated. It was put together by the English Folk Dance and Song Society, and it's got a huge appendix with songs and riddles in Cockney rhyme, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just something to look forward to. Now, Mr. Bacigalupi, or Paola, however you wish to be called, I must ask you a banal question. Your name intrigues me.
Ah.
I'm a sucker for names.
Okay.
There is a kind of folklore called onomastic folklore. It's a study of names and origins. And I must ask you, what is the – first of all, is there an English translation to your last name?
Roughly, it's Kiss of the Wolf.
Kiss of the Wolf. I thought so. Am I correct?
Gallupi, yeah.
Right. Italian heritage?
Yeah. My family came from northern Italy.
To
be really precise, it was like my great-great-grandfather. So I've got this Italian name where I'm really not – I'm like a fake Italian. So,
you're how many generations?
I'm like fifth
American
generation.
Fifth generation.
So, I mean, I'm more French and German and Spanish and a whole bunch of other things.
So when you were a little bambino, you were not – were you told Italian folk and fairy tales?
No, nothing. Nothing like that.
Hippie parents remember.
Right, yeah. No, I was told crunchy granola fables.
Oh, crunchy granola. I like that. Now, when you were reading your story, for some reason, and I don't know why, I was reminded of a Ray Bradbury story called The Little Assassin.
Huh, interesting.
Which is in his book, Something Wicked, October Country.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Which is really wonderful. One of his darkest stories, yes.
Interesting.
Kind of makes you not want to have a pregnant wife. I have to ask you, Jim, you said you're from Colorado. Have you written any stories based on Colorado history or lore?
Not exactly. The one that I've written that's closest to Colorado really is actually one called the Tamarisk Hunter, which actually I think you can find online if you Google it at hcn.org.
What's it called?
The Tamarisk Hunter. Tamarisk is T-A-M-A-R-I-S-K.
What is a tamarisk?
A tamarisk is it's actually an invasive weed. It's a Russian plant that is a water-loving plant, and it grows along the riverbanks of most of many Western rivers now in the United States. And
is it like a killer plant in your story?
It's sort of. It's interesting.
Like
it's
Wells's redweed, or
like kudzu. Right. Yeah.
Well, it's not quite as invasive as kudzu, but it's pretty invasive.
Yeah. I remember reading a kudzu story in a Southern Anthology Nightmare Stories.
Kudzu's fantastic. I love that thing.
One thing that interests me: Jim's idea. What a lovely idea. To take horrible subjects and do comedy, and I have the perfect story for
you. Well, also, Terry Bisson does all.
Oh, right, I know.
No, that was the closest I got to that, was trying to write when I wrote
and
the story.
And Terry's
Six,
name comes to mind also because he wrote a fabulous blurb on one of Paolo's books.
He wrote a story. He wrote, by the way, Scott Westerfeld. Boy, Leviathan is one of my favorite books.
I'm so fetishistic about that book.
I'm looking forward to whatever this is. I don't know if the sequel, it's supposed to be a trilogy, but I'm looking forward. What a way to
Behemoth.
Teach history. I mean, Behemoth, is that out now?
Yeah, it's coming out in the next couple of months, I think.
What a way to teach World War I, the Forgotten War. Anyway, I have a great story for you to deal with in a comedic way. Colorado's favorite cannibal, Alfred Packer.
Alfred Packer.
No, really, Paolo, you really have to do an Alfred Packer story with the punchline that supposedly the judge said to Packer when he was sentencing him, when he said, you know, Mr. Packer, but believe it or not, you are such an anti-Christian, but look at this. There were seven registered Democrats in Hinsdale County, and you went and ate five of them.
Right, yeah.
No, you really have to do the Packer story in a comedy.
No, I love that story.
Well,
yeah.
I like it in The Thin Man myself. It's in the it's Dashiell Hammett wrote it up.
Okay, yeah.
Did?
No.
Yes, he did.
You're putting me on.
No.
He really did
yes.
Alfred Packer?
That's how I know of Alfred Packer, was through reading The Thin Man when I was
learned about
little.
Him in sixth grade. It was one of our favorite stories
you know
in sixth
that,
grade,
you know
learning Colorado history.
You know what they did, you know, Paolo, the last thing I mentioned, I'll see you Tuesday, of course, students at the University of Boulder started in 1932, put up that April Fool's joke on the cafeteria wall.
They
renamed it the Alfred Packer Dining Memorial
Center. That's right.
Center.
Yeah.
The Memorial Cafeteria, yes.
Right.
So that was
ran a WorldCon bid in Colorado once, a fake bid, set in Breckenridge, Colorado. Was an out-of-country bid because Breckenridge has 3 days out of the year in which it's not legally part of the United States.
Oh, okay.
That's a long and not relevant story.
By the way, here's a really dark thing to do. Take a thing like the Sand Creek Affair. With Chivington, I tried to do a comedy on that. I'm not sure that would work, though.
There's we have a lot of dark history. It's interesting. I mean, because mostly I'm focused on our dark present. We have a lot of dark history.
It's difficult not to be.
Colorado is an interesting state. I mean, you know, the name has three meanings. It means red, colored, and off color, as an off color joke.
Huh.
Colorado. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting state. Anyway, we'll see you on Tuesday.
Oh, great.
What a disturbing little story to read. I'm telling you.
Do we know yet what you're reading on Tuesday, if you decided?
I haven't decided yet.
Cool.
I'm trying to make decisions.
I'm actually pleased to hear that.
Yeah, no. I'm
those,
still...
those, you know, find the moment. Find the story for the moment.
Yeah.
Perfect.
By the way,
James, where do we go to eat after that?
Miladies.
Oh, I'm not familiar with it.
Well, you'll find out. I don't want to advertise
places on
the air.
You're not supposed to.
Okay,
all right,
it's
Paolo,
a pub.
Listen, good luck. We'll see you Tuesday.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay. Bye-bye. This is WBAI New York. The show is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. We have a problem with the phone system that it dumps people. We had 12 calls.
And it dumps
people. So call back. It's 212-209-2900, and we have only 6 minutes left.
Oh, wow.
No, time flies. It really does during Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah.
Now, how does the name translate exactly? I figured Wolf was in there.
I was told Kiss of the Wolf, or Wolf's
Wolf.
Kiss, yeah.
Yeah,
so.
So the literal
either that or it's Wolf Kisser, who knows?
Ooh,
so, you know, like.
Okay, but then, you know, for, oh my God, there's a thought.
Right.
It really is. Is there an Italian, is there any equivalent for the concept of Hour of the Wolf? It's mostly a Norwegian Or Swedish.
You're asking a non-Italian about Italian culture.
Okay,
I'm clueless.
Robert will probably call back because he's a folklorist.
Okay.
Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, let me get away from this radio.
Yeah, they're confusing on delay.
Yeah. I heard of it, I just loved Paolo's story. However, my signal here is never that clear. I kind of lost, I think, one of the plot points of the story.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a bad one for audio because I am playing around with time. But go ahead. What's your question?
The idea is the toxins in the world was lowering the quality of the birth rate and the actual success rates of birth.
Not only the success rates of birth, but really actually the viability of the babies. Afterwards.
And is the idea that it's being hidden from the rest of society? Was that the idea?
No. The idea really is that, essentially what happens, is that what we have right now, when a mother is carrying a child, and she's actually passing it a huge amount of whatever she's absorbed whatever she's ingested, whatever she's come in contact throughout her life, all the phthalates, all the PCBs, all the bisphenol A, all those different things, all those chemicals are passing into her fetus and are going to affect the developmental process of the fetus. And that's what happens today, right now. I mean, that's just the way it is. And so we exist at the top of a food chain where a whole lot of things bioaccumulate up into us. And that has profound developmental effects for the children that we have. And so essentially what you have is over time, you're actually concentrating more and more of these things in our later generations. So the idea of this is that essentially that in order to have healthy children, women are having a first baby, which is a non-baby, in order to essentially purge all of those toxins, so that they can have a second baby that's cleaner
and more viable. Yeah.
Right.
That is great and horrifying. That's beautiful.
Yeah. I would say describes a lot of Paolo's writings. Great and horrifying.
Right.
Yeah. That is great. You know, I heard something bizarre today. It kind of relates in the environmental way. I forgot the species of whale, but apparently there was a study on these whales, again, you know, heading towards the top of the food chain.
Right.
And apparently they have accumulated a huge amount of a particular type of heavy metal.
Right.
I think even a radioactive heavy metal in their bodies. And apparently they've done it just simply from breathing the air
right.
on their migratory
mm-hmm.
journeys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was like, that was pretty horrifying, just from breathing the air.
I mean, the most interesting thing to me about sort of environmental science is that everywhere we look, if we bother to look, there are horror stories happening right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's mostly just a process of actually bothering to look. So some scientists say, sort of finally take a look at what's going on with whales, and it turns out they're bioaccumulating all sorts of things. And the act of looking is the only thing that makes it real to us. We sort of assume that the world is proceeding, but it's sort of breaking.
I mean, not to step too far away from the literature, but...
running out of time.
I understand that like Colorado, which now that I realize where you're from, that they have done some fracking drilling, and
yes.
now
yeah.
your water supply has been seriously affected, and they were trying to get away with that same thing up here in New York.
Yeah, the
right.
vote's coming up now, isn't it?
Yeah. Fracking fluid has some really, really weird things in it, benzene, toluene, all sorts of stuff. And so, you know, every time you get to a point where you're going to frack this is for drilling natural gas or for drilling oil wells, every time you're going to do fracking stuff, there's a chance of compromising underground aquifers. And, yeah that has really happened in our area.
We're out of time.
Sorry. Yep. Oh, are you guys going to be reading somewhere around town?
Yes. And I'll announce that right now.
Okay, I'm jumping off the air.
Okay, bye. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great call.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good morning. Okay, yes, Paolo will be reading this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings at 138 Sullivan Street. That's Sullivan Street between Princeton and Houston at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. This Tuesday, it starts at 7, doors open at 6:30. Get there early. Get there on time or early because we're going to be crowded.
Very cool.
And it's extremely cool. So I'll leave people with that and to go to windupgirl.com.
Windupstories.com.
I'm sorry, windupstories.com.
Windupstories.com.
As a portal for all things Paolo Bacigalupi.
Yep.
It has been a fabulous honor.
Thank you so much for having me on here. This is really fun. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Lokley. I will not be here next week. I will be at ReaderCon. And one of my two annual goings. Yeah, we'll both be there. I'm doing a lot at the convention. It's a thrill. I'm interviewing Nalo Hopkinson.
Very cool.
Something with Charlie Strauss. All kinds of stuff. Simon Lokley will be here with Why the Wolf Hasn't Come from 5 to 8:30 a.m. So if you're going to be in the Boston area, go to ReaderCon next week. And if you're in the New York area, again, this Tuesday, come to 138 Sullivan Street and see Paolo and Saladin Ahmed read.
Yep.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
Remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.